Blog Talk Radio.
This is JJ Bomber. You are listening to Well Armed Radio.
Good evening, sheepdogs. Welcome to Well Armed Radio, where freedom is our best friend. Thank you for joining us in our weekly vigorous, relentless, and sometimes ruthless pursuit of freedom. We are broadcasting live from the extraordinarily well-armed studio in New Berlin, Wisconsin. It's my pleasure to speak with the most informed gun owners in the state. That would be you guys. You are your community's finest. With a face for radio and a voice for silent movies, my name is Nick Clark. I'm the president of Wisconsin Carry and the host of Well Armed Radio. And I'm just a free man here trying to stay afloat in the sea of communism. Encourage you to be a part of the show if you so choose by a couple different methods here. You can, if you're listening live, you can call the show 563-999-3787, 563-999-3787. You can also, if you're listening live, interact with the show via the chat mechanism, which is... on the Blog Talk Radio page. If you aren't, I think from a phone you can't do it, but from a computer you can. I think a phone won't use the chat. Or you can make a comment on the Well Armed Radio MeWe page, MeWe.com/P/WellArmedRadio, and I'll try to keep one eye on that too as we go through the show here. But start the show with the usual warning, no sacred cows here, and the first 15 minutes of the show is open line, but we got a little problem tonight, and that is that there's a professional sporting contest in the city of Green Bay going on, and I assume slash expect that a lot of my what might be a live listening audience is going to be listening to, or excuse me, going to be tuning into that professional sporting contest, and that's okay. You'd be better off listening to Well Armed Radio, but you know, I mean, the show is podcast, so you can always catch the show anytime. But truly do appreciate you guys tuning in, and again, would love to have you interact with the show in any way that you feel like you would like to. So we were off last week. And this week we have, what was it? We had Pearl Harbor on, what was that, Tuesday, December 7th. You know, it's kind of funny. it's hard to say. I mean, news media changes so much, but I feel like there was a surprising lack of coverage for Pearl Harbor. And it's been, you know, not to say that in years past it was as robust as it would have been. I mean, I guess, you know, perhaps kind of like September 11th, it just tends to decrease over time. But yeah, very little coverage in the mainstream media, just no real historical reminder, just a mention. And I saw it on one station where it was just a mention of it and like a local interest angle with like a local veteran or something, I don't remember exactly what it was, but no real context, no education on the event. And I think that's something, you know, I know what the media would say. You know, they'd say, well, you know, that was 80 years ago. And the media would say, well, we don't want to foment Asian hate. But it's kind of interesting because, you know, this lack of, again, that's the kind of, if you were to say something to the media, they would, again, they'd point out that Pearl Harbor was such a long time ago, and that they, you know, don't want to drive with the current coronavirus supposedly induced Asian hate crimes on the rise, which I haven't looked at the statistics enough to say if they are or aren't. When I say are or aren't, I'm talking about the Asian hate crimes. But if they are, a lot of the ones that I've seen on TV were hate crimes. You know, there's probably – Asians tend to live and own businesses in very close proximity to the large African-American centers. Example here in Milwaukee, like the Hmong population, the Hmong population, the African-American population, they both – African-American population tends to have a lot of businesses, Asian population that tends to have a lot of businesses, nail salons, that kind of thing. But a lot of the hate crimes that I've seen, or a lot of the crimes that I've seen take place are crimes against Asians from African-Americans in urban centers. But regardless, again, I can see the media saying that, you know, we don't want to foment the Asian hate and we've got a problem with Asian hate crimes. And that's kind of interesting because Pearl Harbor was 80 years ago. Slavery was 160 years ago, but yet the media wants to foment the hate, perpetuate the hate that circled around slavery every day and resurrect it. But I guess hate against white people is worth fomenting. But you know, it's funny because I'd never even heard the name Emmett Till until like the last week or two. And again, it's just like when it comes to the race war, the media will just resurrect sensationalize do everything they can to foster and perpetuate and rehash isn't the word but just to resurrect is probably the best word, to resurrect and then keep a running narrative on this you know, notion that America is racist and all this other stuff. Again, I can't think of a way to more harm a young person's development than to tell them, and I'm talking about like young African-American kids, I can't think of a way to harm their development more than to sit there and tell them from the day they were born that the world, the country's racist. And that hasn't always been the case. When I say, you know, it's definitely been in the last, you know, 10 years, really since Obama. So that's 14 years. And I had to go a little bit back further than that. Maybe I don't think Obama went full racial until after he was elected. He didn't campaign like this race war insider, but then once he got elected, he really went full diversion is not the word I'm for, full race conflict. You know, went put race out there as to try to segregate people, to try to break us into, you know, he just went full on with the race issue, to an issue that I think we are getting closer and closer to getting past. And then Obama brought it back and made it started focusing on the color of people's skin instead of the content of their character, which I think would make Martin Luther King turn over in his grave. Although, who knows? I mean, Martin Luther King, if he was still alive, may have evolved with the times, just like all the other liberals have. And he may well be a big race hustling, race segregation promoting, just like the Jesse Jacksons and the Al Sharptons of the world. You know, it's no way to know. But certainly with the mindset that he had back in the in his time when he was alive, this doesn't fit. This, now all we care about is race. So I'm watching Survivor, and on the show Survivor, they've got, I forget how many people start the season, if it's 20 people or however many start the season. You vote someone off every week. It gets down to fewer and fewer. Well, a few weeks ago, 2-3, maybe a month, there was a cast. This is supposedly the most diverse cast ever. And it's so funny because if everything has to be orchestrated and carefully plotted out, then you would think that the percentage of the cast that was African-American or whatever would then logically need to match the percentage of the cast that the percentage of the population that represents African-American. But like, if you watch TV, you watch a commercial or something, you'd think that our country was 50% African-American with the need for every single, if you're hosting an award show, you got to have a white host and a black host. If you're, have a commercial, you got to have certainly has to have at least one black person, sometimes, a whole family. But again, this is all carefully produced, calculated, orchestrated. It's very intentional. And you might think that if you were trying to make an accurate representation, I mean, that the ratio would then match what the ratio is. If you're trying to be fair, the ratio should match what the ratio is in the overall population. Again, I could care less, but if you're trying to follow some sense of logic, which liberals don't have logic, you would think that having, so anyway, I didn't count the cast of Survivor, but there's a very heavy representation, though. There's at least one Asian this year, but there's a lot of African American, black and brown people on the show this year on Survivor. And so a couple weeks back, four or five of them decide that they're going to have an alliance strictly based upon the color of their skin, because they really want to see a black person win the show this year. And they're sitting there talking about this with absolutely no presence of mind to think about how racist they sound when they're just, they're not talking, hey, we want to have a guy win, whatever. It's just, we want to have an African American. Like, all they cared about was the color of the skin of the person that wins. All they cared about for their alliance was that you had the same color of skin. I mean, it's just so opposite to the notion of what supposedly racial equality was supposed to be. So I'm sitting here watching Survivor, and they've got this alliance of black players that are all going to stick together. And, it's the Black Power Alliance. And during one of the tribal councils, which is the place in the show where you vote people out, the tribe gets together and decides someone has to go home every week. And so they choose collectively who they're going to vote out. And so this one guy, his name's Deshaun, he sits there and he talks about how difficult it is to be an African American on the show Survivor, because you're not just playing for yourself, but you're representing black people. And then at a tribal council a few weeks earlier, this one black female cast member was saying how she's learned to embrace her blackness and how her blackness goes with her everywhere. And it's so racist. I mean, all they care about is the color of your skin. Like, just play the game and be a person. But they can't. This is where we're at today in this world, is we've gone so far past any notion of color blindness to we've come to, I mean, we're back to segregation. We're back to when I say segregation, black people from the inner city, we need police officers that look like us. And it just, all they care about is your color of your skin. And it's just so hyper racist that it boggles my mind that, here on the show, and I, first off, I don't think the general population I think that CBS and the producers of Survivor think that when these racial discussions take place on their show, that it's just that America's just gobbling it up and it's just such great content and everything. And honestly, I think 75%, maybe that's too low, 60% of the population is just rolling their eyes at it, just rolling their eyes at all this hyper race sensitive bullshit on media, but again, in this case on Survivor. So this last week, this guy Deshaun sitting there and he's crying at tribal council talking about how hard it is because he's not just playing for him, but he's got to play for the black community. And I thought, and I, don't get me wrong, I believe him that he feels this way. I mean, it's not an act. He's not, but this is what we've done to, this is what the media has done to the black community in this country, is first convince them that they have to all be homogenous. They have to all be, they're all one people. They're not, no, it's the black community. And start to identify as, isolate yourselves as each other, segregate yourselves as each other, and then put all this pressure on them that the world is racist and the world is, it's not fair and you can't, all the bigotry of low expectations, all these other things, and then make everything about race and then make everything about the color of your skin. And I believe that this particular character, Deshaun, does feel that pressure. I've used this example before. I've talked to people who think that they're black, and they've said, Nick, oh yeah, then they're conservatives, but they've said, oh yeah, the world is, it's still a very racist country. And I say, well, why do you say that? Give me an example of where you've experienced racism in your life. And I've also observed this on TV, on news interviews and stuff like that, where they're talking to a person, they'll say, well, give me an example of where you've experienced racism. And the things that they people often cite are things that, sometimes they'll cite something like, oh, well, when I was, I've overheard people use the N word. And the first thing I think is, oh, was it in a rap lyric? Because that's where I hear the N-word most, is rap lyrics. And from, I hear the N-word more from rap lyrics. No, forget rap lyrics, forget music. I hear the N-word more from black people than I hear it from any place else. In fact, 99.9% of the time I hear the N-word, it's from black people. And not just the nigga, but the full the full nuclear version. I mean, Lena Taylor in the bank. And I mean, the full-on use of the word that's this kryptonite, radioactive hydrogen bomb of a word that you can't even say the real word. I hear that far more from, when I say far more, 99.9% of the time I hear it's from a black person. Sometimes to a black person, sometimes to another person, but just to them, the word is thrown out there like candy at a parade, at a Christmas parade. But yet if someone else uses it, oh, that's racist. That's, that's an example of when they experience racism, they heard someone say that word. But that's one. But I've also heard black people that I've talked to, and again, and also seen in news interviews and things, but some that I've personally talked to, that they were conservatives, and I've said, well, give me an example of racism. They said, well, I'll go to the grocery store, and the clerk, at the cashier, a white person was in line before me, and she talked to them, but as soon as she got to me, she took one look at me and didn't say a word to me, didn't say hi, didn't say anything. And that was where they felt that they experienced discrimination, they experienced racism. And I think to myself, my God, I walk into a store and I'll have the clerk, I mean, customer service is dead. I walk into the Pick and Save, and the cashier, they don't even acknowledge you're there. They just start checking out your stuff. I mean, there was a time, 15, 20 years ago, where you walk into a store and the clerks were taught to greet every customer. I mean, I worked at McDonald's and, hi, welcome to McDonald's. How can I help you today? I mean, you were supposed to greet every customer. When I was in high school and I worked, I was a junior. Yeah, when I was a junior and I worked at McDonald's, my first quote, real job. I mean, I had a paper route, but I think my first, shift work job was working at McDonald's, my first hourly pay job working at McDonald's. If I stood there at the cash register and a customer walked in looking up at the menu board and I just stood there and waited for them to come up to the cash register, I would have got yelled at for not greeting the customer. We were supposed to greet every single customer. You walk into a cashier now, into a grocery store, you're checking out. The cashier, she could be halfway through your thing. I mean, I've had cashiers that never said a word. I just thought, I'm going to say nothing and see if they say anything. And I mean, I've had times where I get all the way through the whole thing, and the first time they say something is to tell you your total, 58.25 or whatever. So I don't know. Now I'll go and I'll be the one to say hi. The cashier starts checking me out and I'll say, hey, how's your day? Which, I have no problem doing. But again, when I was younger, that was customer service, that the cashier was supposed to say that. You were supposed to greet the customer. I mean, you know, that's part of customer service. So what I now see is just poor customer service. I've had Black people tell me, well, that's an example of the racism that they experience. So I think it's a self-fulfilling prophecy in a lot of cases. And again, I'm not saying anybody's never been discriminated against. Of course, I wouldn't say that. But so this guy, Deshaun, on Survivor, I mean, he's just sitting there and he's upset and he's crying. And I think to myself, if I was on that show, I would say, you know what, Deshaun, have you ever thought about just letting it all go? Have you ever thought about just letting go of this feeling that you're obligated to live for the Black community and represent Black people? And just be Deshaun. Just be yourself. You don't represent anybody but you. You don't represent other people whose skin color happens to be the same as yours or a slightly different tone than yours or somewhere between yours and a white person's skin. I mean, I don't think that I represent German people. I mean, I'm just Scotch-Irish and German, and the only thing that I think that means about me is that I like beer and whiskey, being German and Scotch-Irish. But, I mean, it's just amazing to me. And I see this on TV and in the media, and I think in one sense it's sad, in one sense it's frustrating, in one sense it's maddening, but I sit there and I think we've created this. Again, now we've got to have people that, I need role models that look like me. Again, completely racist. We're teaching kids that. And we're conditioning kids that, you need police officers in your neighborhood that look like you. I mean, that's segregation. That's intentional segregation. I mean, we used to try to desegregate and now we're intentionally segregating. It's just, for me, it's so obviously the wrong direction to go if you really want to get to equality, and which is the thing of it. There's a lot of people that really don't want to get to equality. Equality does not interest them, but that's what I'm after. And then I will call out this racist bullshit. So I'll sit there when I'm watching Survivor with my fiance on Fridays. We record it and watch it on Fridays, and our daughters will be sitting there. They're her daughters, I call them ours. And I'll just, when I call it out, when I see it, I'm like, how incredibly racist. When I see a news report and they start talking about something and I'm just like, how incredibly racist. I call it right out every time I see it. It amazes me. So again, this last week, that's my connection here. I'm watching this lack of coverage of Pearl Harbor, and I think about the reasons why the media wouldn't want to do that. And, we don't want to foment Asian hate. And that was 80 years ago. It's in the past. Let it be in the past. And that's their theory when it comes to something like Pearl Harbor. But their theory when it comes to something like slavery, which was double 160 years ago, they want to foment the hate every day. They want to remind us of it every day. They want to remind us of the historical. You've got to know the historical context of slavery. But you don't have to know the historical context of Pearl Harbor. You don't have to know the historical context of the Holocaust. I mean, I'm hearing from people that they don't even teach. They focus very, very little on the Holocaust. Like, this was, the 1940s. So, again, 80 years ago, plus or minus, when in Germany, they were slaughtering millions of people because of their, I guess it's their religion. I mean, is it race? I mean, Jewish, I guess that's race. It's both. I don't know. Jewish is kind of a race. It's kind of a race and religion, wouldn't it be? Because, I mean, if you're from Israel, you're Jewish. Or are you Israeli? I don't even know the answer to that. I mean, I think Jewish is a, religion, not a race. But maybe it is. Maybe I'm wrong. Anyway, so there was a time in Europe that they were slaughtering people by the millions because of their religion, because of their, again, race slash heritage, because of their ethnicity. And that's something that I don't think they teach much in public schools. I certainly don't think they focus on it like they did when we were in school. We talked about how terrible it was, how terrible the Holocaust was, how terrible Nazi Germany was. And I just don't sense that any desire to keep that notion fresh. And again, I guess this is why history repeats itself, because, you know, when you don't teach history, when you don't learn history, it does repeat itself. So again, I was just kind of surprised at the lack of coverage of Pearl Harbor, and the little bit of coverage that there was no historical reminder. It was just like, hey, this happened, a little local interest angle, you know, no context on the education, you know, unprovoked. It just that surprised me. But next thing I was going to talk about today, I don't want to take too long to get into this, because I promised on the, when I shared this to the Wisconsin Carry Facebook page, that we had and I didn't even notice this coming up. I mean, I write the checks for these lawsuits and the appeals, and we hear from the attorney when there's a hearing and all this stuff. I didn't even know that oral arguments were taking place. And then I find out, I think it was Monday or Tuesday, I can't remember which day, that oral arguments had taken place. Wisconsin Carry's attorney sent a message and said, hey, just a heads up, we had oral arguments for the Dubeck case in front of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And so this is John Monroe's, Wisconsin Carry's attorney, great guy, great attorney. And so I was able to, you know, catch that, watch some of it on Wisconsin Eye. What I found out is that you could only watch the arguments for free for the first 24 hours. Then after that, you have to be a subscriber to Wisconsin Eye. I think it's like 10 bucks a month. So I did get to watch, and it's funny because by the time I got around to watching, it was just about 24 hours, and I started watching it prior to the 24 hours, and then while I didn't get through watching the whole thing, and then it cut me off, and I couldn't get the video, and you can still go listen to the oral arguments. Those are in the Wisconsin Supreme Court archives. Like, you just go to, just if you Google Wisconsin Supreme Court oral arguments, you can hear them. So I did listen to all the oral arguments. I got to see John Monroe's making his oral arguments. And then I didn't get to see his rebuttal. I just heard his rebuttal. And then the state was there as well. And this is just my impression from watching it. It must suck to be a Democrat, because you're always pushing angles that don't have a lot of logic behind them. But I want to summarize this case for people, because I think it's something that a lot of Wisconsin Carry members aren't aware of. But it's a really important case, and it's one that we've kind of had in the works for a while. Obviously, it takes a while to get up to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So this case, Dubeck versus Josh Call, Daniel Dubeck is the guy's name. So basically what happened was Daniel Dubeck had a concealed carry license, owns firearms. He's been purchasing firearms over the years. And then a few years back, I want to say it was 2019, he went to purchase a gun at Cabela's, and he was denied. And then subsequently his concealed carry license was revoked. So he reached out to one of the attorneys for Wisconsin, one of the attorneys who's on Wisconsin Carry's board of directors. And then that attorney put him in touch with John Monroe / mentioned John Monroe's name. And this guy turned around and got in touch with John Monroe. Over the years, I've had a lot of people contact me and say, hey, Nick, I was denied my concealed carry license, or I've been denied a purchase, and, you know, this isn't right. You know, I bought guns in the past. And I said, well, tell me about, you know, have you ever had a conviction for domestic violence? And they said, well, I've got just misdemeanors, but I had a disorderly conduct one time. And I said, okay, that disorderly conduct that you had, was any part of that a domestic violence incident? And they say, well, I got in an argument with my wife, but then when they told me I pled guilty to disorderly conduct, they told me there was no domestic violence. I wasn't charged with domestic violence. There was no domestic violence enhancer. I never touched my wife. It was just a disorderly conduct after a domestic incident. And I said, well, that's the Lautenberg Amendment. Anything that has an, if the element of your crime, domestic violence involved, then you're shit out of luck. Well, that's been the case, you know, and I've probably had, I mean, dozens of people that have reached out to me over the years, probably scores of people that have reached out to me over the years with a similar situation when they got denied or they had their license revoked. And I said, hey, look, you know, you're kind of out of luck. That's the Lautenberg Amendment. Yeah, it sucks. It's ensnared, you know, thousands of people, and then across the country, probably hundreds of thousands of people have been ensnared by that. And the people that I have to say this to, they're disappointed, they're frustrated because they're saying, look, I specifically asked, you know, does this have any effect when I pled guilty to disorderly conduct? And they said no. And now I'm hearing from the Wisconsin Department of Justice that it does affect my gun rights. You know what? So anyway, so those cases had come to me prior to this case that found its way through one of Wisconsin Carey's attorneys. So this guy, Dan Dubek, reached out to Joe Olson, one of the members of Wisconsin Carey's board of directors. Also, because Joe mentioned it, he hunted down John Monroe's contact information and reached out to John Monroe. So John Monroe brought it back to us, to Wisconsin Carey, and said, hey, I'm going to help this guy either way, but this is a case that could have some statewide precedent because John has mentioned in the past that he thinks that based upon the Lautenberg statute, the Lautenberg Amendment, and based upon federal case law, along with Wisconsin statutes and Wisconsin's case law, that disorderly conduct can never be MCDV is misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. He's suggesting that disorderly conduct can never be MCDV. And over the years, it's been hard to really wrap my head around that because it's a very, as our attorney has described it, it's a nuanced legal argument. So I just kind of take his word for it. For me, it was kind of like calculus. You get these formulas or these theorems. This is how you do this kind of problem. You know, proving that theorem is something that like geniuses have done. So you can't visualize it. You can't logic your way through it. You just have to say, hey, this is the formula to solve this kind of problem, this kind of equation. You just got to apply it. And you really can't, unless you're like a really high level math genius, you're not going to be able to visualize it. You're not going to be able to prove the theorem to yourself because that would take, you know, calculations that spread over the course of a whole, you know, chalkboard. Whenever you see like some college thing where this guy's proving a theorem and he's got every chalkboard in the this big lecture hall full of equations to prove it, you know, that's how some of these equations, some of these formulas, these mathematical formulas get proven. Anyway, you just have to take their word for it. So I just kind of took John Monroe's word for it that, you know, there's this legal argument that disorderly conduct can never be in Wisconsin, disorderly conduct can never be a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. So here's how I would summarize this case for you. So this Dubek case was one where we thought that we could get some precedent set. And so we took Wisconsin Carey, took the case. Wisconsin Carey has funded the case. I've actually never talked to Dan Dubek. I'd actually like to. So it's funny. I've written all the checks for this lawsuit, and I've never actually talked to Dan myself. But here's how I would describe this case. So a felony is a felony. In Wisconsin, a felony disqualifies a person, and in a lot of states, a felony disqualifies a person from getting a concealed carry license and owning or possessing a firearm. But in 1996, the U.S. Congress passed what's been referred to as, and you've heard me use it on the show, as the Lautenberg Amendment. It actually has a different name. The statute actually has a different name, but it's colloquially known as the Lautenberg Amendment. And that Lautenberg Amendment essentially says that even a misdemeanor crime can result in a loss of gun rights if it's a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. So this was around, again, mid-90s. That was, gun control was still kind of in vogue then. I think that was just prior to Columbine. And, you know, domestic violence was a problem. So we want to keep people that are, you know, abusive husbands from being able to get guns. because they're, you know, of the high incidence of murder between a husband killing his wife or whatever. So we want to keep guns out of the hands of domestic abusers. That's kind of what the altruistic motive of this was. And of course, what it ends up doing is it ends up ensnaring all kinds of people that it really probably wasn't intended to, unless you're a Democrat and then you want to intend to take the gun rights from anybody you possibly can. But I think the Republicans that went along with the Lautenberg Amendment were Republicans that never intended that it would end up being used in the way that it was, which is, again, the folly of Republicans, because they never evaluate. They can't predict. They're not intelligent enough to see the law of unintended consequences, or they're just more interested in the political cachet, the political opportunism of being tough on crime and protecting women or something like that. So anyway, so the Lautenberg Amendment passes in 1996. But then the issue comes up, what exactly constitutes domestic violence? Because it's just to say that, you know, if you're convicted of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, you can't get a gun. Well, then you have to define, so what is domestic violence? So the United States Supreme Court has weighed in on this through case law and through the statutes itself, but it's clearly defined what meets the standard of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. And that is binding precedent because it's the United States Supreme Court. So in Wisconsin, the disorderly conduct statute is so broad and vague that even violence in the disorderly conduct statute, because in Wisconsin, disorderly conduct is defined as things that are, you know, abusive, profane, violent, or otherwise disorderly. So violent, the word violent is used in there, or that tends to provoke a disturbance, or you know, that's the disorderly conduct statute, just very, very broad. It's the kind of something that you could, which makes it easy to convict people of it. Oh, they caused a disturbance. It was, their behavior was disorderly. It's a catch-all. That's what we used to see people try to get charged with when they were open carrying or something. And those were usually defeated or, you know, once they actually dove into the law, those charges might not have been pursued and dropped. But disorderly conduct is kind of what they try to throw at everything. But in Wisconsin, because that law is so vague, the standard for what is violent, the disorderly conduct statute as defined by Wisconsin case law doesn't meet the standard of what the United States Supreme Court said that violence had to be in order to trigger the Lautenberg Amendment. For example, under Wisconsin's disorderly conduct misdemeanor, let me back up. Under the U.S. Supreme Court, for something to qualify as domestic violence, it had to involve unwanted touching. So unwanted touching would be like hitting, I mean, making physical contact with someone, or intended unwanted touching. So if you took a swing at your wife but you missed, you didn't touch her, but you attempted to touch her in a way that she wouldn't have wanted to be touched. By that meaning slapped, punched, hit, and the reverse could be true, a woman slapping a guy. So domestic violence under the federal statute has to involve unwanted touching or attempted unwanted touching. But in Wisconsin, the disorderly conduct statute, screaming at someone could be deemed violent, and screaming at someone, there is no touching involved, no physical contact involved, and no attempted physical contact involved. But under the federal Lautenberg Amendment, the U.S. Supreme Court said that doesn't qualify as violent. Screaming doesn't qualify as violent under the Lautenberg Amendment. So for this reason, it's the position of Wisconsin Carry and our attorneys that disorderly conduct can never constitute domestic violence. Stated differently, Wisconsin's disorderly conduct statute sets the bar so low to be considered violent that it doesn't meet the bar the U.S. Supreme Court set for something to be considered violent under the Lautenberg Amendment. Now, how does this... the actual legal mechanisms of the United States Supreme Court said that a statute can't have some elements that are violent and some that are nonviolent, then that whole statute doesn't apply as a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. So there is some disorderly conduct that could be violent. You could slap your wife, make physical contact with her, get charged with disorderly conduct, and that certainly would be domestic violence in the dictionary definition and even under the federal definition because it involved unwanted touching. But because the federal statute, the Lautenberg Amendment, says that all the elements of a crime have to be involved violence, and because there is the disorderly conduct that isn't meeting the standard of violence, the whole statute doesn't qualify as a triggering mechanism for the Lautenberg Amendment. So that's our attorney's argument. Again, it's a little hard to follow because it's more than just saying the standard for violence in under the federal law is higher than the standard for violence for disorderly conduct, so therefore disorderly conduct doesn't meet it. It's really more than that. It's because in all the elements of a statute, all the elements of a crime have to be violent in order for it to qualify under the Lautenberg Amendment. So if sometimes disorderly, the Lautenberg Amendment, the United States Supreme Court case law would say that if sometimes disorderly conduct is violent and sometimes disorderly conduct is not violent by the federal definition, that whole statute can't be used under the Lautenberg Amendment. So Josh Call can't say your disorderly conduct misdemeanor triggers the federal Lautenberg Amendment when the U.S. Supreme Court has set a standard for violent that Wisconsin's disorderly conduct law doesn't meet in every circumstance. And because it doesn't meet it in every circumstance, it can't qualify as misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. Now, other misdemeanors could still meet the federal Lautenberg Amendment for being violent. For example, battery. Under this battery statute, battery always involves unwanted touching. Battery always involves that physical contact. So there, you can't get charged with battery without and convicted of battery without an element of that crime being violent, because everything under the battery statute meets the federal definition of violent, being unwanted touching. So anyway, so that's what the crux of this case is. And listening to the oral arguments, the justices, to my untrained ear, semi-trained ear, seem to be very, very skeptical. By very skeptical, some of the justices made statements to the states. I think, I forget his name, I think it was Keenan, the assistant attorney general who was drew the short straw and had to fight. And again, it sucks having to, this is the great thing about being, for me, being a conservative, it's easy to argue something that you believe in and that has facts and logic on your side. If you, like when people say, oh, like when you're on the debate team, you were given a position, you had to defend it no matter what, like that, I could just never do. Cause if I looked at something and said, no, I don't think that this is the right position, I'm not going to make up things to support a position that I don't truly think is the right one just for the purposes of being strong in debate, because to me that comes off as dishonest, and honesty is one of the most important attributes you can possibly have. And so if you don't have your word, your honesty, you can't even make logical arguments because people can't believe you, and you have to be believed if you want to be agreed with or to have someone conclude that you're correct. So anyway, so I feel, well, I don't really feel bad, but it's unfortunate for this poor assistant attorney general that he's given the task of defending something that's kind of logic that you really can't defend. So he appeared to be grasping. He appeared to be making arguments that he himself even didn't really think that were logical. And even the liberals on the court, when they were asking him questions, seemed to, in some cases, come right out and say that, hey, if we, in order to agree with you, we kind of have to disagree with this other particular Wisconsin case law. And then again, it appeared that the oral arguments went really, really, really well for Wisconsin Carry, for our attorney, and for the angle that we have. Now, why is this important? Because we think that there's probably, you know, upwards of 1,000 people who've had revocations or denials because they were, take a step back for a second here. What we think happened. And we can't know because we don't know what's going on inside the DOJ. I mean, maybe if we did open records requests for emails, we might find a memo that says, hey, we're going to go back and we're going to scrutinize concealed carry license holders looking for misdemeanor crimes and domestic violence. And so we're going to start with anybody who was ever convicted of disorderly conduct. And maybe that memo exists, but we haven't done that. You know, Wisconsin Carry hasn't dug into it that, and it doesn't really matter. What really matters is, you know, setting this precedent that we want to set. So what we think, the most logical thing that we think happened is that when Josh Call was elected, he had some of his minions go about combing through the concealed carry license applications, records, and looking for people with misdemeanor crimes of domestic violence and flagging them. And then those particular cases, going and looking at the charging documents, looking at perhaps even police reports to look for elements of domestic violence in any of those disorderly conduct citations, and then revoking the people that received those disorderly conduct citations or disorderly conduct convictions. So really big case, because, you know, we think there's probably, you know, thousands of people or more than 1,000 people who've lost their license because of this. And then those are just the ones, there may well be people who didn't apply for their license because they were under the impression that their disorderly conduct citation, because it involved an element of domestic violence, precludes them from getting their concealed carry license and or buying firearms. So important case. And look, this isn't because we want to have, you know, wife beaters be able to carry guns and be on the street. The point is that if the district attorney didn't think that that an incident rose to the level of, you know, domestic violence, because they could have charged battery. And look, if you're charged with battery and it has the misdemeanor, or excuse me, domestic violence enhancer attached to it, you're screwed. That's Lautenberg Amendment. You know, if you are certainly, you beat your wife and you're charged with a felony, because there's some that are, you know, you could domestic incidents that we charge as felonies, then that would proclivate you, you know, that would, you wouldn't be able to get a concealed carry license, own guns. But these minor crimes, I know people that have gotten, I shouldn't say I know people, I know of people that have gotten in bar fights, got charged with misdemeanor battery multiple times, and they can get their concealed carry license because they don't have a felony and their misdemeanor battery convictions were with some stranger at a bar. But then I know a guy who slapped, I know of one case where a guy who slapped his stepson got charged with this, with disorderly conduct, but because it was his stepson, that becomes a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence because he slapped his stepson. Now, that guy who slapped his stepson 20 years ago and hasn't been able to get a concealed carry license, he would now be able to get his concealed carry license. He'd be legal to, you know, the Lautenberg Amendment wouldn't apply to him because it, so some of the other ways that some of this could be happening is in Wisconsin, we have the handgun hotline where background checks go through versus the federal NICS checks, which is a federal system. So it's possible that people who bought a handgun, because that goes through Wisconsin's handgun hotline, were scrutinized differently than people who bought a gun that went through the National Instinct, I think it's NICS, National Instinct Criminal Check System. Anyway, NICS. So again, important case, and the oral arguments went well. It's probably going to be a month or two till we get the decision in that case. But an important case nonetheless, and this is the state Supreme Court. So this sets statewide precedent. So a really big case. When that decision comes down, it'll probably get more press. I did Vicki McKenna's show this week, but I didn't see any other news stations covering it or anything like that. Just didn't hit their radar. When the press release actually comes down, I will probably – excuse me. When the decision actually comes down, if it's favorable, I'll probably issue a press release at that point, the media will probably be all over it. And then Democrats will be up in arms. Oh, Wisconsin carries helping domestic abusers get guns. I mean, that's what the messaging is going to be. But I don't know if you guys saw this, Merry Christmas, Chicago style. So when I was younger, my grandmother, she lived in a suburb of Chicago. I think it was Elgin and maybe a couple other suburbs that she had lived in as well. But I remember as a kid, one of the fascinating childhood memories was my grandmother would drive us down, and I think my dad was with, but we'd drive to downtown Chicago to window shop on the Magnificent Mile on Michigan Avenue during the Christmas season. Don't really recall ever going into stores, but these stores on Michigan Avenue, I don't know if they still do it because I haven't been to Chicago over Christmas in quite a while, but I know they used to have just these amazingly cool window displays. It was a thing. And people would go just to window shop down on the Magnificent Mile in Chicago because they had these wonderful Christmas displays that people would go down to see. So, I remember my grandmother taking us down there to see those at least once. I don't know if there was more than once. But so several years back, I took my daughters to Chicago on a shopping spree. This had to be probably, 2016, 2015, 2016, 2017. It was a few years back. But I took my daughters down to Chicago to a little shopping spree prior to Christmas. It was somewhere between Thanksgiving and Christmas. You couldn't pay me to go near that place now, even if Illinois recognized Wisconsin's concealed carry licenses. Michigan Avenue is literally under siege. Michigan Avenue is where all the shops are, you know, everything from Coach to, I forget some of the more high-end, Lord & Taylor, some of the more high-end retailers down there. But you've got this mob violence, this retail mob violence that's been taking place. You might have seen it on the news. The smash and grabs, it's happened here in the Midwest, but it's also, you see a lot of it down in California. Real high-end stores getting broken, not even broken into, it's in the light of day, just, you know, large number of a mob of people go in all at once and grab expensive merchandise. I think sometimes they're going in, they're taking like $250,000 of merchandise in one, you know, in the matter of a few minutes into these stores. And so Chicago has had this problem as well. And so this was a story on Fox News that for the weekend, this is this weekend, that Chicago was, so now this is the weekend that's already taken place, but that Chicago had released a plan for the weekend. And they were, now in Fox News, they call it closing off downtown, but essentially they were going to raise the bridges. So if you're familiar with Chicago, like the Chicago River comes off Lake Michigan, you go through the, I forget the name of the lock, but there's a lock there. I've been through it on multiple boats that I've owned. You go through the lock, you're in the Chicago, you're right by Navy Pier. You go through the lock, you're in the Chicago River. You're going, and then as you're coming westbound, the loop is to the south of you, the south bank of the river. And then on the right side, you pass Streeterville, River North, the Magnificent Mile neighborhood, because Chicago has all these neighborhoods. They go by neighborhoods, River North, Near North. That's on your right as you're going in. So you go under the, this isn't the right order, but you go under Lakeshore Drive. That's a ways out. That's right, you know, close to the lake. And then I forget if it's Columbus Avenue is the first one, but there's the bridges would be Columbus, Michigan, Clark Street, I believe, is one of them. Anyway, these are all the bridges that connect the loop, which is really the businessy part with the Magnificent Mile, the north part, which is you get north of the river. It's more residential and more retail and more entertainment. And then so the plan in Chicago was to raise the bridges and literally lay siege to the shopping districts to prevent violence, to prevent some of these the inflow of people in and out that might be doing these mob ransacking of stores. And I think to myself, for the incredibly high, you know, who would want to go? You know, they're trying to do this to keep it safe for the shoppers, but What shopper wants to go to the Magnificent Mile in Chicago to go shopping when you know that they had to raise the bridges to get into that area to keep the threat of mob violence from, I mean, you just not go. And you think the Christmas season, it's the incredibly high rents of all those high-end retailers on Michigan Avenue. I mean, I couldn't think of a more terrible marketing campaign to drive customers away. So here, I mean, you've got on Michigan Avenue, you've got Nike Town, you've got Coach, you've got, again, it's been a few years since I've been there, but these places that pay huge, huge rents, you've got Water Tower Place with all the stores in Water Tower Place. These people that pay huge, huge, huge rents for these retailers for a storefront on Michigan Avenue, and some of what would I think be some of the busiest shopping days of the year, they're going to raise the bridges and put you under siege to keep criminals, looters and mobsters, or mobsters, not literal mobsters, a mob of rioters to come in. This is 2021. This is a major urban area. I mean, what the hell is going on in this country? And again, this is Chicago. Sometimes it feels like it was a different country, but I mean, law and order is just, it's almost unfathomable, because I remember in the late 90s and then early 2000s, and you got Rudy Giuliani as the mayor of New York, and New York was all of a sudden such a safe place. And, you know, you thought crime was defeated, and you really, especially as, you know, I was probably in the 2000s, I was in my 20s, you know, you feel like crime, the crime problem had been solved, that, you know, the crack crime wave of the 90s, 80s was over, and, you know, that it was just, the country was a safer place. And then here we are 20 years from that. And that, again, you realize that these things go cyclical. And this is what happens when you get places become too safe, and then the libs get wild ideas to start doing all this social justice, social engineering, soft on crime, rehabilitative justice, using the streets of jail. And all of a sudden here we are with incredibly unsafe metropolitan areas again. It's just, you know, it's just, I want to say it's unfathomable, but then again, it's very fathomable, knowing how liberals ruin everything that they touch. But yeah, that's Chicago. Some of the busiest shopping weekends of the year, some of the most high-profile shopping weekends of the year, and some of the most high-profile places to go destination shop of Chicago. And here you've got I don't know if they did it, but this was the plan. They were going to raise all those bridges going across the Chicago River to keep people from, you know, there's still, I'm thinking, that would certainly keep the bus traffic. They would have to change the bus routes. Mass transit in Chicago, there's not a lot. Along the loop, there's a bajillion L stops. You take the L, you know, you start up in Lincoln Park and you go down, then you're underground. It's elevated train in Lincoln Park. You go underground when you go through the River North area, through the northern north of the Chicago River. And then when you get down to the loop, you come back above ground. So I think in most cases, there's some places where the L is above the Chicago River. You go over the river, I think, over by Merchandise Mart. I think the L is above the river there. I'm not sure. But then there's other places where the subway goes under the Chicago River and then comes up. Well, the subway goes in the loop. There's the subway, and then there's also the L. The subway is the L. It's one system called the L. But in the loop area, there's part of it that's underground, part of it that's above ground. So there's just a whole bunch more L stops in the loop. There's not a lot of L stops north of the river. Like, I think you have to get off at, I want to say State. I think there's only a couple L stops. They're subway stops north of the river. But anyway, it's so just, it would really, raising those bridges would really make it difficult to get in to the shopping district area. Difficult for criminals, but also difficult for customers. And again, it just, it's mind-boggling that that's what they got to do in Chicago, or that's their solution in Chicago, is to, you know, lay siege to the this very chic downtown area in order to keep crime out. But yeah, it's 2021. I mean, you know, it's, so that's your Merry Christmas Chicago style. Another thing I was going to bring up this week was Matt, I don't even know how to say his last name, Vasily Gambros is a reporter with the Pew Institute or the Pew Trust. And so I did an interview with him last week, and he was a reporter. So he reached out by email. I called him on the phone. He's a reporter with Stateline, which he calls a nonpartisan news service funded by the Pew Charitable Trusts, covering state and local policy. And so he said he's writing a quick story about the six states this year that enacted permitless / constitutional carry legislation and the states that are currently debating similar measures, including Wisconsin. So he wanted to highlight that this has been a priority of gun rights advocates in recent years, and it's that it's been quite successful. So he wanted to get my take on it, about why it's been so successful in passing, what the policy benefits of these laws are, and how I feel about the chances of legislation passing in Wisconsin. So I called him back. It was interesting because when I watched his actual story, he didn't go into much detail. And see, reporters often lie to me. They often say that what they're looking for isn't really what they're looking for. They're kind of looking for the a soundbite. And again, in this case, not a soundbite because it's going to be printed. It's going to be text. But I've often found that reporters don't give me their honest angle on a story. They give me a different angle, but enough that's going to elicit a couple comments from me that they think that they can use, and give them the quote from me, the soundbite of the quote from me that they want. So I talked to Matt on the phone and gave him the whole scoop on the concealed carry legislation in Wisconsin. And what I really told him is that, you know, I took him back to the history of concealed carry. Scott Walker killed constitutional carry here in Wisconsin. I think I even took him back further than that. We almost had concealed carry back in 2003. It was one parliamentary trick from passing then. Then it almost passed again, I believe, in 2005. I think the veto override came up one vote short. I think that was I'm not sure if that was the Gary Sherman veto override where he changed his vote. So it came up one vote short in the veto override back again. I think that was maybe 2005. So we were really close to getting concealed carry a couple times. Then when Scott Walker was running for governor, it was a fait accompli. Everybody knew that if we got a Republican governor, we were going to get concealed carry. That it was just a matter of what we got. Wisconsin carry advocated strongly for constitutional carry, got it to the floor of the Senate before Scott Walker went on TV and said, any bill that makes it to my desk must have mandatory training and a permit. The next day, Milwaukee Talk Radio, with the exception of Vicki McKenna, Milwaukee Talk Radio goes on the air, and oh, the kook fringe, who was the guy? Charlie Sykes called Nick Clark from Wisconsin Carry that I was part of the kook fringe and that I was a hack. So then once Jay Weber was threw shade on constitutional carry, I remember hearing Mark Belling saying, you know, this should have been the easiest thing to pass. And then you got to get these fringe elements that are pushing for these, you know, extreme carry bills. And so everybody but Vicki McKenna threw constitutional carry under the bus. That's where constitutional carry died. We had it again with Senator Craig introducing constitutional carry a few years ago. And that was again, we had a Republican governor, Republican Senate, Republican Assembly. This was Senate Bill 169. This was when we had the Free Families from Felonies Fits campaign where Black Friday of 2017, I think it was, Black Friday 2017, I'm driving around Scott Fitzgerald's Wisconsin Senate district, dropping off highway signs that said, "Hey, Fitz, be pro-gun, protect parents from felonies." And then I don't think we put the Senate bill on there, but anyway, that was the Free Families from Felonies Fitz initiative. Never got a vote. Word was that Scott Walker, the quote from Scott Walker was, "We don't need this right now." 2017 was just before the election year. 2018 was an election year, which is one that Scott Walker actually lost. But that was the history there for constitutional carry. So now, and that's what I told Matt. I said, you know, this isn't going to go anywhere in Wisconsin. Tony Evers will veto it. And honestly, it's purely political because once if a Republican governor is elected in 2022 and takes office in January 2023, I'm confident that this bill won't get reintroduced. Or if it does, it won't get the support that it has right now. Because I don't think Republicans really want to pass it. They could have passed it if they want to. They're just using it as a cudgel to make Tony Evers look like the anti-gun tyrant that he is. But there was a couple more things I wanted to share with Matt. And so I sent him an email after we got off the phone. I said, you know, Matt, I was pondering some of the questions that he had posed since we got off the phone. And he had asked, you know, why constitutional carry and permitless carry has been proliferating across the country. And there's a couple reasons for that. I mean, people, the one reason is that constitutional carry is the next logical step. I mean, if you want to push gun rights legislation, once you have concealed carry, the next thing that you can push for is constitutional carry. So you don't have to have a training and a permit. I explained why people don't want to be on government databases and things like that. But it's more than that. And after I thought about it, I shared this, that my opinion based on observation is experience is that legislation doesn't drive cultural change. Legislation follows cultural change. So these legislators in all these states, they're not innovators and they don't seek to push the envelope testing new movements or new initiatives. Rather, they seek to gain political support by offering people what they perceive people want. That's the nature of politics. It's not about the next new greatest thing and being innovative and creating demand. It's about capturing the demand that they think is out there. So the answer to why is permitless carry becoming so popular? I think you have to first recognize that permitless carry is becoming popular because carry in general has become popular with riots and civil unrest, the proliferation of crime, the failure of the criminal justice system, you know, those reasons which I could dive into much more detail on. But at the end of the day, I think people feel less safe. And it's like I said to Matt, this reporter on the phone, when people feel less safe, their instinct is to get a gun and to be able to protect themselves and their family. People can turn on the TV and they see violent crime, from carjackings to sexual assaults to armed robbery to mass shootings. So it's a natural reaction to want to be able to protect yourself. They go buy a gun. And when people see riots and civil unrest and police are not able to, or they're ordered not to protect citizens, then people take matters into their own hands and they go buy a gun and they carry for self-defense. So people turn on the news, they see what's going on, or they look outside their front door, depending on where they live, and they see what's going on, and they realize the government has failed to keep them safe, and they know that they are the only one who can keep themselves safe. And I believe that's definitely a majority opinion. I believe the majority of Americans feel safe. So given that view, it's quite natural that politicians would want to glom onto that for political advantage. So everybody's going out and buying guns. More and more people are carrying. And so constitutional carry / permitless carry, it makes it easier for the average person to carry for self-defense. So permitless carry removes the obstacles to entry to begin to carry. Because like I said to this reporter on the phone, with constitutional carry, there's something in it for everyone. You know, the people on the right that don't want to be on government databases or have government know that they carry a gun, there's something in it for them. Democrat-leaning voters in inner cities who don't want to be on those databases also necessarily. But in addition, you know, these Democrats in inner cities, Democrat-leaning voters, they don't want to pay the permit fee and they don't want to have to find and pay for the mandatory training that often comes with obtaining a concealed carry license and paying the renewals. I mean, look, if you ever hear someone doing an interview, this is just an observation. Whenever I turn on, whether it's court TV, whether it's when they're interviewing a black person who lives in the inner city, their smoke detectors are always going off. They're not going off. The low battery alarm on their smoke detectors is always going off. You know, that chirp every how many seconds. And it's uncanny. Every time I hear someone interviewing someone on TV and I hear that, it's a black dude or chick that's being interviewed. These people don't even want to change the batteries in their smoke detectors. I think a lot of it is because if they're rentals, I think your landlord is responsible for that. So who wants to go out and spend money on batteries when that's your landlord's responsibility? That's the reason why all these people who I hear in the game, they always happen to be black, but their smoke alarms are always doing the low battery chirp on their interviews. Again, I've seen people on Court TV, the nationally broadcast network, and they're doing their Zoom from their living room or whatever, a Zoom in to join, or from their office, and you can hear their beep, beep. You hear that smoke alarm chirp every 30 seconds from their low battery. And it must be a black thing. It must not bother them. It must be that they live in a rental and they're waiting for someone else to replace it. But again, if you don't want to replace the batteries in your smoke detector, you're not going to want to pay $22 every 5 years to renew your concealed carry license. You're not going to want to pay $40 to get your concealed carry license. It's not a big obstacle to entry, but the permit is an obstacle to entry for people to conceal carry. So again, I think there's something, permitless carry offers something for everybody. It offers something for the Democrat-leaning voters in their cities. It offers something for the right-wingers that don't want to be in government databases. But that's why I think that permitless carry is proliferating across the country, because the carry movement is growing. The next political opportunity that a politician can push to attach themselves to is the cultural trend towards gun carry, and that's to advocate for permitless carry. So again, legislators are not innovators. There's some politicians that advocate for permitless carry as a matter of principle, and I'm thinking about the Second Amendment shall not be infringed type, but it's not the bulk of politicians. Most politicians care far, far more about political opportunism than principle, and for that reason, they support constitutional carry / permitless carry. Because as concealed carry has grown to wide support across the majority of the population, it's politically advantageous to support constitutional carry. But again, you have to remember, politicians are not innovators. The only reason that politicians are pushing, the only reason that you have a voting majority of politicians pushing permitless carry is because carry in general is so popular. If carry in general wasn't so popular, constitutional carry would not be advancing like it is. But carry in general is popular even among Democrats. And again, I've made this comment. There's Democrat politicians in other states that are more pro-gun than the Republican politicians in this state, than some of the Republican politicians in this state. So there's never going to be enough politicians who supported constitutional carry by principle to pass it. But the politicians who seize on cultural shifts now realize a political opportunity for permitless carry. And for that reason, they've joined the principled politicians who've always advocated for constitutional carry because it's the right thing. And that created this majority voting bloc in legislatures to pass permitless carry. And again, that's my opinion based upon observation and experience. Constitutional carry isn't the root motivation. People feeling unsafe across the country is the root cause of the proliferation of permitless carry. People feel unsafe, they buy guns, they want to carry guns. The growth of concealed carry is a cultural shift that politicians want to attach themselves to. Once you already have shall issue, the only way to attach yourself to the concealed carry movement legislatively advantageously is to push for the next step, which is permitless carry. Then I thought more about Matt's angle and the audience for his story. So thinking about the anti-gun audience that's probably going to read, and I'm thinking about Matt's story. I said, Matt doesn't really want to tell about the virtues of constitutional carry. I'm certain that that's not his goal here. He's probably trying to share with the liberal readers of his column, even though he says nonpartisan, share with the liberal readers of his column. They're probably most interested in how do we stop this? How do we stop this proliferation of permitless carry? And I'm not afraid to go there. You know, I don't feel like I'm giving information to the enemy, because the things that they would have to do to stop the proliferation of permitless carry would be good for the country. So I sent him another email. I said, hey, Matt, as I think about Matt's the reporter, I said, as I think about the audience for your story, for Democrats who don't like to see the proliferation of guns and permitless carry, they would need to address the demand side of this situation. Because right now the demand is there for carry rights because of crime, because of civil unrest. So if Democrats want to undercut the demand, if Democrats are trying to reverse this trend of permitless carry, constitutional carry, if Democrats want to undercut the demand for guns and for carry rights, they should deal with the crime issues. Get violent criminals off the street so that people feel safer. Because it's not just enough to candy coat the news coverage to not cover crime. You can't buck the reality that people see out in their daily life. When your friend was carjacked, when your friend was held up. I mean, look at outside of Marquette University. They're having all kinds of problems with armed robberies and such of students. When someone you know or you were affected by violent crime, you know that crime is out there. And, you know, it doesn't matter that the news media doesn't report crime because they're trying to suppress the amount of crime that exists out there. But so if Democrats want to undercut the demand for guns, they got to deal with the crime issue. Get violent criminals off of the street so people feel safe. If people feel safe, they won't mind outsourcing their self-defense to the government in the form of the police, because they won't realize that can't always be there, because if there's less crime, there'll just be less crime happening and less need for people to be carrying for self-defense and feeling that need to carry for self-defense. But again, you just can't buck the reality that people see out there in daily life. You can only suppress it on the news so much. People are going to realize how much crime is really out there. But Democrats who run metropolitan areas, they could undercut the demand for guns and for carry by fixing their criminal justice system. I mean, the people that are committing this violent crime, we have a list of the people that are going to be committing all the murders and the armed robberies. Almost all of those take place from people who are already in the criminal justice system, repeat criminals. So if they would punish, you know, put violent criminals behind bars, punish less violent crime with more substantive measures like carjackings and robbery to defer repeat crime, which tends to get more violent. You know, don't allow peaceful protests to become violent riots at night. People in Kenosha went running to buy guns when the riots started happening. So if the Democrats would stop those riots from happening, they would have undercut the demand for guns. But the Democrats thought that that was politically advantageous for them to have these riots, and they ended up increasing the demand for guns. So the last thing would have to be that the media could stop sensationalizing mass shootings. And of course a mass shooting is going to be covered in the news. But I think the risk of an actual mass shooting in the traditional syntax, you know, not the new definition of mass shootings that includes inner city violence as mass shootings, you know, a drive-by shooting takes place from one rival gang member to another rival drug dealer and three people are shot, boom, that's considered a mass shooting. That's a very different scenario than the random guy goes into a mall and starts shooting strangers. Guy goes into a school, the kids go into school and start shooting up the school. That's a different kind of mass shooting than what they're now calling mass shootings. So I think that Democrat politicians used the media to overhype the risk of a mass shooting, thinking that it would create demand for gun control. But instead, it just created demand for more guns and carry permits. And that's reflected in recent polling as well. I mean, Democrats now more strongly support gun control, but the support for gun control among Republicans and independents has dropped dramatically. I think a week ago, I saw that it was like a 15% drop in the support for gun control among independents and Republicans, compared to an increase in the support for gun control among Democrats. But losing those independents on the gun control issue, I think Democrats have now realized that their sensationalizing of mass shootings in the media, which they thought would create demand for gun control, instead just created demand for guns. And it seems like they're backing off of that, which is why I think some of the recent, quote, mass shootings didn't get the sensationalism that they used to. I think Democrats have realized that mass shootings don't drive gun control as much as they drive gun purchases and the demand for guns. So was another situation or another interaction I had with the reporter I thought I'd share with you guys to give you a little bit of detailed understanding of how I see the gun rights debate playing out, permitless carry, that kind of thing. When it comes to legislation, this is another situation where Republicans are just woefully inept at playing offense, at using situations to advance good legislation. So after the Rittenhouse verdict, you know, Jacob Blake's family is now seeking for changes in gun laws. Jacob Blake's family now wants changes in gun laws so that 17-year-olds can't, they want to close the loophole. They want to close, Ralph says it makes sense. I'm so buried into the issue that I can see these. And that's why I wasn't afraid to share with the Democrats, share with a reporter what Democrats would need to do to decrease the demand for guns, because I know Democrats aren't going to do that. But again, one thing I think Democrats are doing is I do think Democrats have learned that sensationalizing mass shootings thought was never letting a crisis go to waste. This will increase the hue and cry for gun control, turned around and instead just increase the demand for guns, backfired on them. But Jacob Blake's family, they now want to close this supposed loophole that allowed Kyle Rittenhouse to legally carry that AR-15 because it's not a short-barreled rifle or short-barreled shotgun. So the news, Channel 6, went to Senator Van Wangard and asked him for a comment, and he issued a statement. And this is regarding this proposal from Jacob Blake's family. Now, the first thing I would say is the fact that Jacob Blake's family is the torchbearer for this call for gun control. I mean, good grief. Jacob Blake was a dirtbag. He sexually assaulted his girlfriend, his baby mama. You guys know the story. I've told it here on the show before. I don't know if he broke into her house or barged into her house. She was in bed. He shoved his finger up her vagina, pulled it out, smelled it, and said, "It smells like you've been with other men," accused her of cheating on him. I think that time he might have taken her car and crashed it too, but then that's what she called the police, got a restraining order against him. He was arrested for sexual assault, charged with sexual assault, felony sexual assault, charged with disorderly conduct with the domestic violence enhancers. And then that restraining order is the reason that when he showed up at her house again, tried to steal her car with her car, not his, her car with their kids that he wasn't supposed to be around. He wasn't supposed to be around her. Police get called. They try to tase him. He pulls out the prongs, pulls a knife, goes to get back in the car and essentially kidnap his own kids. That's why he got shot by the police. This guy is a dirtbag. And why his family is now the torchbearer for this call for gun control is just befuddles me, because that's even disconnected from the Kyle Rittenhouse case, because if anything, you would think that Jacob Blake's family would be calling for some kind of law change with regard to police use of force or something. But the people that were, you know, then these protests after the Jacob Blake shooting, when Kyle Rittenhouse ends up shooting three white dudes, again, it just, I don't see how Jacob Blake's family is now somehow the torchbearer for the media figurehead for this call for gun control. It just doesn't even make sense to me. But this was, but nonetheless, they are. So they're calling for this change to gun laws to close this, what they call a loophole, so that 17-year-olds, and I think they actually want to raise, they're calling for raising the age to 21 to be able to possess a gun in Wisconsin. But so the news goes to Senator Van Wangard, and they ask him for a statement. And this is his statement. He says, in the last 30 years, the law hasn't been a problem, and there have been no issues. Rushing to change any law based on a single event or incident is never a good idea. I will look at the legislation and take a deliberate approach to it like I do all bills. Now, that was Senator Van Wangard's statement. Now, it's not a terrible response per se, but it's actually still weak as hell and a total hedge. If I'm not going to nitpick the language, because I don't want to just nitpick the language that he uses, but the tone of his response seems to be a total middle-of-the-road safe play, noncommittal. It kind of leaves the door open to go either way in the future, depending on which way Van perceives the political winds blow as this proposal makes its way through the media. Because he didn't say no. He didn't say this bill is dead on arrival, I'm not moving it forward in my committee, blah, 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 blah. He says, he puts that, you know, well, you know, changing a law just based upon a single event is never a good idea, but I'll look at the legislation and take a deliberative approach like I do all bills. He's leaving the door open, so that way if the calls flood into his office and say, oh, I want you to support this, then he's got himself the wiggle room there, just not even wiggle room, but he's left the door open to support it. If all the calls come in against it, you know, he's leaving that option open. It's a typical politician play, not principled, not strong. But I think it's a huge missed opportunity. And when I say missed opportunity, that's for me because, see, I'm actually interested in advancing gun rights, and I'm sometimes make the mistake of thinking that legislatures want to also. But remember, the primary interest of legislators is getting reelected. The primary interest of legislators is political power. So, I've only got 2.5 minutes left here in the live broadcast, so I'm going to lose you here in a minute, Ralph. Thanks for popping in here from Ralph from Pleasant Prairie is in tonight listening live. But I do think it's a huge missed opportunity for Van here because he could have played offense instead of just playing defense. Now, again, I understand Republicans never play offense because Republicans aren't really about advancing gun rights and advancing freedom. Their first interest is getting reelected, gaining political power, and they don't perceive that being out front on some of these issues does that. Because they watch too much TV, they think that the phony reality that the media presents of public sentiment is really public sentiment, and it's not. It misrepresents public sentiment. But so that's the reason why guys like Van Wangard don't go and play offense. First, they probably don't know how to play offense, but even if they did, they probably wouldn't because they're not in tune to the real opportunities to attract support from people, which is what Trump found. Trump found a way. Think about that. A 70-year-old billionaire from New York was able to relate to, you know, we rode through the Kettle Moraine. Well, every weekend we ride through the Kettle Moraine because we go up there hiking with the dog. But, you know, I'm riding through the Kettle Moraine on a Saturday yesterday, and we're driving through some little tiny road and a little tiny, well, it's not even a small town. It wasn't even near any towns, but we're up in the Kettle Moraine in the middle of nowhere. And there's a guy who painted his barn. I think it was on Butler Lake Road up by Butler Lake in the northern Kettle Moraine. And Ralph, have a great night. Thanks for tuning in. I'm going to lose you on the live feed here. So great. Great to have you in. But up here on Butler Lake Road in the northern Kettle Moraine, we've got a guy who was so moved by Trump, by Trump's presidency, that he paints the whole side of his barn, Trump 2020, you know. And I think a 70-year-old billionaire from New York was able to connect with a, I don't know how old the guy that owns that property was in Northern Catamaran, but a, I don't want to call him a hillbilly or anything like that because I don't know the guy, but just a very, very rural country folk boater from Osceola, Wisconsin, or Dundee. I don't know what the actual town is, but he's, this is right by Long Lake up in the Northern Catamaran. I mean, the furthest, I mean, you, okay, you can get further from New York. You could go to the mountains in Montana, and you could go to the North Woods in Wisconsin and be further. But I mean, this is almost as far from New York as you could get metaphorically and demographically. Almost as far as you can get from New York demographically, this little tiny farm in on Butler Lake Road in Osceola, Wisconsin, or Dundee, Wisconsin. But Trump was able to connect, not just connect and just get the guy's vote, but just connect with him in a way that the guy paints the side of his barn. And that, and he's maintained it because it's, Trump lost, that was over a year ago. And this guy still has it up, didn't repaint his barn, didn't paint over it. And we think Trump will run again in 2024, but we still got a couple years to go before that comes to fruition. But just think about that. Think about how Trump was able to connect with, this is what Republicans don't realize. If you act on behalf, there is a level of support from people that don't usually engage in politics that is so strong if you can tap into it. And Trump tapped into it. And Republicans, I thought they were going to learn from it, and maybe a few did, but still so many haven't. If Van Vanguard wanted to be the most popular guy, I mean, look at Sheriff Clark. Sheriff Clark became, I think, arguably the most popular politician in Wisconsin. I mean, he got elected in Milwaukee County by like 70-some percent, for Christ's sake. Loved by conservatives, and yet elected in Milwaukee County with 70% of the vote, being an outspoken conservative. And what was his biggest thing? Being pro-gun. He was unabashedly pro-gun, outspoken pro-gun. It just shocks me that more politicians didn't recognize this and say, hey, if I want to be, Sheriff Clark became a national figure solely based on being pro-gun. It wasn't because he was a conservative, because he's conservative on a lot of things. It wasn't his support for, you know, criminal, tough on crime. It was his pro-gun support that launched Sheriff Clark into national stardom. And again, it just shocks me that more Republicans don't say, hey, if not for the principled reason, if just for the fact that wanting to be a political superstar, just be mega outspoken pro-gun and you can be that. Anyway, so this is the comment from Van Vanguard, you know, that little hedge message about this proposed new legislation. Here's what I would say, and here's how you play offense on something like this, which Republicans never do. But how do you play offense in a case like this where the Jacob Blake family calls for changes to gun laws? So what I would say, and what I actually did say to Channel 4 when they interviewed me, was first, if Kyle Rittenhouse didn't have that gun, he might be dead. So if anybody is proposing to change the law that allowed a 17-year-old to save their life, I guess essentially what they're saying is they wish that Kyle Rittenhouse was dead. That doesn't make any sense at all. What happened with Kyle Rittenhouse proves that a 17-year-old needed a gun for self-defense and he might be dead without it. And I'm sorry the family of Jacob Blake would rather have an innocent person dead than his attackers, but given the background of Jacob Blake, I'm not surprised that his family supports criminals over victims. But that's how you get boom in the face of the media. Media is going to flip the fuck out and you'll wag the dog. If you come on there and make that offensive kind of, and I don't mean offensive like in a insulting kind of way, but just make a bold statement the media will cover it because they think they're going to make you look like this insensitive jerk. You'll be demonized by the media, but the voting public will totally be behind you. You have to have the principles, the courage, and the connection to the pulse of real people, not just the media. But you got to play offense. And you know, that statement that I made is probably too bold for V-Dub, Vanguard. But he could have played offense by suggesting, and this is what I wanted to issue a press release from Wisconsin Kerry, but I couldn't come to a meeting of the minds with the Wisconsin Kerry Board of Directors. I want to issue a press release, and I don't want to mention this proposal, or now it's, I think it's been introduced as bill, but I'm not sure, to change the age for carry possession to 21. But this is the time to go full bore. There's currently a bill, it was introduced by Shea Sortwell. There's currently a bill out there to lower the age to get a concealed carry license to 18 from 21. That bill has already been introduced in the assembly. And that is playing offense. Right now, Vanguard should say, you know, the bill that I think we're going to move forward is the bill to lower the age to 18 for a concealed carry license, because what we've seen recently is that more people really need that ability for self-defense. And you can currently open carry if you're 18. And we just think it makes more sense to allow 18-year-olds who take the safety class, pass the background check, get their license to conceal carry. That's playing offense. The bill won't pass. Tony Evers is going to veto it. But it's reframing the conversation. It's taking a shot on goal. Yeah, it's a Hail Mary, but Hail Marys are sometimes caught. When you go on offense, it forces the libs to defend your proposal instead of you defending theirs. It puts the conversation on a logical argument that really does have the moral high ground. You can open carry at 18. Why not solve some potential problems and let 18-year-olds conceal? Felons are still prohibited from carrying. But this is why, like, Democrats never let a crisis go to waste. Republicans never take advantage, and I won't even call it a crisis, Republicans never take advantage of a situation. After the riots in Kenosha and the riots in Milwaukee and the riots in Wauwatosa last year, the Republicans should have been calling special legislative sessions proposing riot protection acts, with things like what I said before, like some kind of addition to Castle Doctrine, that during times of civil unrest, if there's a curfew in place, that triggers the ability to protect property using deadly force. You know, something like that. There's ways that you could parameter that out. Play some damn offense. It ain't going to pass. Tony Evers is going to veto it. But you let all the pro-freedom folks know you're fighting for them, and you frame the conversation in a way that's beneficial to your side and your cause. Civil unrest was a problem last year and continues to be sporadically here and there, but it was a huge problem last year. There was a freedom solution. There was a solution. There was, as the Rittenhouse case demonstrated, the fact that the National Guard wasn't called out, the fact that businesses were being burned and business owners were being assaulted, that was proof positive that we need the law-abiding needed more help. And that help could have come from the National Guard, but it could have also come from the legislature. But instead of taking advantage of the situation and passing some good legislation, you know, Republicans just wring their hands and criticize Tony Evers because he didn't call the National Guard. And they don't fully leverage these opportunities to push for freedom-minded shit, because the Democrats love to leverage these opportunities to take away our rights. Anyway, what do we got here? This story is evergreen. I'll save that one for next week. Did you see this story? I put it on the Well-Armed Radio page. There was a girl, a female basketball player. She was black in California, who runs down the court, misses a shot. As she's running back up the court, the mom goes, "Oh, you let that girl do that too?" She didn't even get fouled, but the girl that was on the other team that was near her when she was guarding her, the mother's like, "You need to hit her." And so this one black player just slugs and like knocks her to the ground. This other girl, she's run up the court, complete blindside, completely uncalled for. The girl didn't even foul her. There was wasn't provoked at all. And then it turns out that this girl who sucker punched the other girl is a daughter of an NBA player, former NBA player. I think Corey Benjamin was his name or something like that. But it was so funny because now the mother who said from the stands to her daughter, you need to hit her, she's being charged with contributing to the delinquency of a minor. I still haven't heard if the daughter is getting charged with assault for hitting the girl, which I think she should be. But then it was funny because the dad issues a statement, Corey Benjamin, who's the dad of this girl who goes out and slugs the other girl in the head, in the neck. But it's the reason I shake my head is because I'm trying to find it. The statement that Corey Benjamin makes. Here's a quote. The girl's father, Corey Benjamin, stated on social media after the incident that he was, quote, shocked and disappointed at my daughter's behavior, as this is not a reflection of the values and standards that my family holds. And that was a report from a quote from Fox 11 in Los Angeles, which is so funny because actually, Corey, it's clearly your daughter's behavior is clearly a reflection of your family values and the standards that your family holds, because your baby mama, because you're, I don't know if they're still together, but your daughter sucker punched another girl after your baby mama, who was either your wife or your ex, egged her on. I mean, that's family values on display, proof positive. I mean, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. That was just a funny story. Not a funny story, but a head-shaking story I saw this week. My last story I got is about Scott Walker and how his politics continue to haunt Wisconsin, but it's getting late here. I'm going to save that for next week. I'm going to go turn on the TV, watch the news, see if the Packers got their butts kicked or not, and take it from there. Hope you guys enjoyed the show. Hope you guys had a great week. Weird week now. It was all cold this weekend. Not super cold, but, you know, colder-ish. Seasonal, I guess, would be a better word. But now this week we're supposed to get warm up this week, I think by Wednesday it's supposed to maybe hit 60, and then by Saturday we're supposed to be back down. The high for Saturday I think is 23. so that's Wisconsin weather for you. 60 on Wednesday, people probably be out playing golf. Oh, excuse me. And then highs of 23 for Saturday, which is, it's not bitter cold, but that's well below average high temperatures for this time of year. So you guys have a great week. Carry on, and I'll probably be doing it next Sunday. Hope you join us here. Be well armed.
Sniper Chick Julie, you've been listening to Well Armed Radio, and I have to know, is that a gun in your pants, or did you just really enjoy the show?
Stop listening to the bombastic loudmouths on the radio and television and the internet. To hell with them.